and all ability labels are represented through storytelling, film, dance, theater, and music. HurleyvilleArtsCenter.org. And from listeners like you.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected. On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
Set it off with your host, Clive Alvin Yates III. Set it off.
Saturday night at 7.
Set it off.
On Radio Catskill.
Good evening and welcome to the local edition, local news and information to keep you connected in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm Jason Dole. And tonight it's the Kingfisher Project. Bill Williams will be live with guest. Kingfisher Project is heard only here on Radio Catskills Local Edition. We're going to get right into that program right now, live here on the Local Edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project. Information and awareness about the heroin and opiate epidemic. I'm Julie Pizzol. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pizzol, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
Okay, Bill, I don't think you heard the intro, but it's time for you to start.
Okay, I did not hear the intro, but here we are. My guest tonight is Tracy Gardner. We could use up the entire show going through Tracy's extended biography and accomplishments. Here's a brief sketch. As the Legal Action Center's Vice President of Policy Advocacy, Tracy directs LAC's policy advocacy work, spearheads major initiatives, and fosters strategic partnerships that support LAC's mission. Tracy has worked more than 30 years in the public health, public policy, and not-for-profit fields as a policy advocate, trainer, and lobbyist. She has led advocacy campaigns that achieved substantial increases in funding and landmark policy reforms in the areas of substance use, HIV, alternatives to incarceration, and reentry services, and community and correctional health. Let's leave it at that and hear from this tireless advocate directly. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you, Bill.
Let's work backwards. Rather than going through history, let's start with what's on your mind today. What do we know? What can we learn? What bothers you? What would you like to say?
Well, I don't know. Each day brings something new, but it's, life is precious and not guaranteed. That's kind of the big theme today. I'm especially affected by the death of the actor Michael K. Williams and some other young people who... preliminarily, it's believed to have be using drugs contaminated with fentanyl. And I don't know how much you want me to kind of do exposition and explain certain things, but at the very least, the overdose epidemic that we're in the midst of even kind of running concurrently with COVID, has resulted in the highest number of overdoses that we've ever seen in this country. 90,000 overdose deaths happened in 2020 alone. And more than 60% of them were due to synthetic opioids, synthetic fentanyl. And here's the issue, really, is that supply is contaminated. What do I mean by that? If there were some contaminant at the Johnny Walker Red production company, there would be a way to trace it down, to trace down the batches that it was in, and to engage the people who may have accidentally had a drink with Johnny Walker Red with this contaminant in it. And then Johnny Walker Red would have been subject to some kind of review or regulation, something to ensure that it doesn't happen again and that the supply of Johnny Walker Red is safe. We have safe supplies of liquor, of cigarettes, of coffee. We have safe supply of drugs. And so the fact that we make a distinction between what's a legal drug and what is not legal has no rhyme or reason in the face of this many deaths. So I am feeling like I don't even want to call it overdose deaths as much as poisoning, death by poisoning. And there are things that we can do that are immediate and effective, but the cowardice of elected officials or the backlash from uninformed communities keeps us from being able to do those things. What are those things? We call them harm reduction interventions, and they include everything from each time a person injects their drugs, they should have a clean syringe, syringe exchange programs where people bring their syringes and get new clean ones and also get connected to care and opportunities for treatment in a non-judgmental and welcoming space. And then we have overdose prevention sites, which is where people are able to use their drugs in medically supervised or supervised so that if they encounter contaminated drugs, if they are in the process of an overdose, they can be revived. Narcan should be available as easy as it is to buy cigarettes. And everyone should carry them. Instead, we're still stuck in our language of the 70s and 80s, the just say no, the enabling, we can't enable drug users, and that abstinence is the only way to combat active drug use. I'll close by saying what I think we have discovered, if we didn't realize it at any other time, is that the opposite of active addiction is not abstinence. The opposite of active addiction is connection. And COVID showed us how so important it is for us to be connected. And what can happen when we are in prolonged isolation, when we are turned away, when we don't have options to get connected. So, you know, I'm going to get on my soapbox, but I'll get off for now.
No, I love you on your soapbox. One thing that struck me thinking about Michael K. Williams, who most people or many people might recognize as Omar from the series The Wire, was that he died alone.
That's right.
And it made me think about Philip Seymour Hoffman, Whitney Houston, Prince. You hear these famous people who've all died alone, and you don't have to be famous to die alone, although I'm sure in some ways it may help. but they don't. If there were any sense of harm reduction, they would know about just a buddy system in terms of using.
That's right.
The fact that they were so disconnected that they couldn't have somebody else available to them to talk about what they were doing without feeling shamed over it.
That's right.
It's very, very disturbing.
That's right. And that's exactly the point, is that that's why we talk about when you are in the throes of active addiction, it's not a party. It's not a social event. It's self-isolation. It's compounded by shame and the stigma of asking for help. And it usually is accompanied by someone who is in a great deal of pain, who is looking to alleviate that pain. So there are a lot of people who believe that, you know, being addicted to substances is a moral failure, particularly substances that are legal or illegal. And we don't know enough, and there's more to learn, certainly, about the nature of substance use disorder, active addiction. I know that you've probably read Dr. Carl Hart's book, Drug Use for Grownups.
And I have.
That book is one that lays out or kind of pokes holes in a number of kind of widely accepted truths. And so his book, while popular, will never get the visibility that the Office of National Drug Control Policy under, you know, previous administrations has been able to have in terms of a bully pulpit to say, just say no, or prevention when you are faced with the prospect of using drugs or drinking, particularly for our folks, our young people. That is a major piece of the war on drugs machinery, which is to villainize and criminalize all aspects of drug use and to infuse it with a dangerousness that undermines the credibility of these authorities, of these health authorities. The issues around cannabis, and while, yes, it is a drug, and, yes, it can affect young brains, but to say that it's associated or to have purported that it was associated with death and harm on the level of, say, alcohol or cigarettes really undermine the authority. We make decisions to do what's called harm reduction every day, including putting on seatbelts. That's a popular one. To put on seatbelts means you're trying to reduce the harm in case of a car accident. We talk about fentanyl test strips. We talk about not using alone. We talk about Good Samaritan laws. All of that falls within the rubric of harm reduction, where health, the health of the individual, the health of the individual who's using drugs is of value. There are a lot of people who don't believe that.
Well, having read his book and our last guest, I think you know my last guest on this show is Maya Solovit, mm-hmm. who mentions you in her book. We'll get to that. That compassion seems to be what we're lacking.
Yeah.
When we are able to develop a little more compassion and understanding, we might make some progress.
That's right. But it just doesn't happen in, obviously, overnight. And we are now in the midst of policies that were put into place not just 40 years ago, but some would argue 400 years ago. When you are trying to villainize and criminalize a particular group of people, and this is something that the United States has a great deal of experience in doing, not just people brought from Africa, people who lived in Mexico, people who came here to build our trainways from China. We liked other. It's almost as American as apple pie. We're this and you're that. And so the treatment, the addiction treatment system, and the is grounded in treating people, quote-unquote treating people, who are not valued. And so when people who are valued, i.e. white people, started struggling with prescription pill addiction or using heroin, having been hooked through prescription pills, they got to discover the addiction treatment system that has been sufficient for black and brown people in this country for decades. And it was found to be lacking, it was found to be not compassionate, and it was found to be not evidence-based. And so that's where we are now, where with opioid use disorder, or just even using an opioid, having opioid use disorder medication in your body reduces your risk of overdose. We need to get people on medication if they choose. But when we do, when they do have opioid use medication, which is the FDA-approved medications are methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, when they have these in their system, their risk for overdose is less. We still are learning so much about the nature of the brain and the body and how they are so deeply connected, even though we have systems that treat them separately. We have a system for the health of the brain, and we have a system for the health of the body. And if it's in the same person, this doesn't make sense. I also suspect we're just going to look back. We're going to look back at this time and be astounded at how cruel and medieval we were and how we treated people with a health condition. I really do.
Let's, you've been at this for 30 years or more. Tell us a little bit about your work at the Legal Action Center. What you do, and what you're doing to help get around some of these problems or to get through or beyond these problems.
Well, Legal Action Center, which is a policy advocacy organization, and we work and have always worked since the 70s when we were founded at that intersection of health and the criminal legal system. And by health, we mean substance use, we mean mental health, we mean HIV, because these are all health conditions that have been exacerbated when they have had a justice response instead of a health response. So when in New York State, when the Rockefeller drug laws were passed, we actually litigated to make them less cool than they already were, and took it all the way to the Supreme Court, lost, but Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote the dissent that then the New York State legislature used to amend the Rockefeller drug laws. It's hard to imagine that they would have been harsher than they were, but they were much harsher before this early amendment. So we have worked on discrimination, fighting discrimination against people with health issues, including NIMBY issues, when communities don't want treatment programs in their backyard, not in my backyard. But there is a need for the treatment program. We have litigated when people have been discriminated against because of their HIV status or because they were on medications to treat opioid use disorder. And so every issue that's out there that can even be remotely, you know, accompanied by stigma that then feeds into discrimination and oppression I've always said stigma and oppression are almost interchangeable because of their impact. So this is what we do at Legal Action Center, and we do it by our legal services that we provide directly to individuals. We do it through our litigation, which can help make case law and change the minds of people who are doing this kind of discrimination by threatening them with a lawsuit. And we also do policy advocacy work that's based a lot on what we have seen our clients fight. A lot of the communities that we served who've been over-policed, who have had the decades, multiple decades impact of things like Rockefeller drug laws impact their communities even today. We work on the fact that with attended to our this country's mass incarceration, there are many people walking around with criminal convictions who are unable to get work, housing, and other opportunities long after they've served their sentence because of the scarlet A of the conviction. So that's the kind of stuff we do. We're based in New York. We work at the national level. We work in states around the country. But I would definitely say that our work is about fighting discrimination of any kind, but particularly around these health issues. And we use a variety of ways to do it.
Let me ask you a question. Earlier this summer, you posted in an email about five bills that had been passed by the state legislature and were waiting for the governor to sign.
I'm only
aware of one that he signed. What's the status on that? Or have they expired?
No, they haven't expired. So you may have heard that we had a little change in the executive chambers of New York State. And so...
Well put.
And so those bills that were before Governor Cuomo are ostensibly also available for Governor Hochul to sign. What's not clear is whether the bills in their current form, having been passed by the State Assembly and the State Senate, will be simply signed by Governor Hochul because they're part of an overdose package for New York State, or whether they will ask for changes, which is called a chapter amendment that is proposed by the governor, and that means that the bill goes back to the legislature to be amended and revoted on. So the bills that remain unsigned are MAT, medication-assisted treatment in corrections, one that you and I have talked about, and so the risk of overdose for people in incarceration and leaving incarceration is 1,000 times higher than for individuals out in the community when they don't have medication in their system for their opioid use disorder. Their risk of overdose is astronomical. There is a bill to eliminate what is called prior authorization in insurance, in this case in Medicaid, which means that the insurance companies can no longer demand that providers seek their approval before prescribing medication for substance use disorder. That used to be par for the course. If this bill is signed, they won't be able to do that anymore. And then the last bill is a syringe decriminalization bill, which is part of a larger package of legislation that was passed and signed by then Governor Pataki, a Republican. Because at that point, that is when the HIV infection, Hep C, were at an all-time high among people who injected drugs and their partners. And it was also factored into the pediatric AIDS cases that of children born to women who either used themselves or had a sex partner who did. So this bill was signed, and advocates like Legal Action Center were able to make the case to the legislature, to the Republican Senate, and to the Republican governor that this bill was going to save lives. There has been amendments since then, because possession of syringes for a very long time has been illegal, and then particularly if it has residue in it. But in a state that was almost first in setting up syringe exchange programs, how are people supposed to bring discarded syringes to be exchanged if they're vulnerable to being arrested simply for being in possession? Just like we say with safer sex, a condom every single time, for safer injection, it has to be a clean syringe every single time, or at the very least, never sharing. So those are the four bills. Three bills that remain to be signed. And the one bill that was signed by Governor Cuomo was to allocate opioid settlement dollars from the attorney generals around the country lawsuit against a number of prescription pill manufacturers. And so, like tobacco settlement, it will be millions of dollars paid out over something like 10 years to address the damages done by the prescription overdose. However, some would argue that it is going to also be used to shore up and create the 21st century evidence-based treatment system that we should have had all along, to support harm reduction strategies that engage people who are actively using, and to support prevention activities so that people have more than scare tactics, but information really to be armed with about why, if at all, they should use or should not use drugs.
We're getting a little short on time. Do you have any idea about how likely these bills are to be passed? I know the new governor has a dog in this fight. She's lost a family member to addiction.
That's right. I think I'm not sure, to be honest, where it is. The current governor absolutely understands these issues in a way that is very deep and personal, and she has heard a lot because of it. She headed up the heroin task force something like 4 years ago, the state heroin task force. So it's not clear yet whether the bills will be, as they say, called up for her to sign, or if she and her new staff will have changes that they want to make. Because the bills have already been passed in both houses of the legislature, it will require them to be repassed if she feels the need to amend them.
Got it. One last quick question, if I may, and think of this as your 30-second question. Who are any heroes or heroines you have in this whole long-time fight?
The men and women who nurtured me and taught me about the value of life back in 1989 when an HIV diagnosis meant death. These are the people who informed the foundation of what I care about, what I work on, and what I do. And that they, because it was personal for them, they were able to convey the urgency, but also the need for compassionate approaches to people who use drugs. Those are my heroes. Some still here, some gone.
You hear the music, Tracy?
I don't.
Well, I thought I was hearing some music. I think it's time for us to say goodbye. Thank you so much. We need to clone you so there are hundreds of you, thousands of
What a nightmare.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bill. Stay healthy.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
This has been the Kingfisher Project live on Radio Catskills Local Edition. Come back next first Tuesday of the month in October for more with Bill Williams. This has been live radio right here on Local Edition. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned. Music Emporium's coming right up here on WJFF Jeffersonville.
The Sullivan County Dramatic